Now let's talk about real estate prices in farm country. Commodity prices remain high. Investors are funneling millions of dollars into buying farmland. But that is actually making it more difficult for the next generation of farmers. Harvest Public Media's Clay Masters has this report from Nebraska.
25-year-old Austin Bruins is driving 40 miles an hour, windows down on a dirt country road in a noisy 18-wheeler. He's got a little more than a 5 o'clock shadow, hinting at long days of an early harvest.
When I graduated from high school, I didn't really have my sights set on anything. You know, I knew I didn't have any ground. I was going to come home and farm.
So Bruins went to school to become a diesel mechanic and later joined the National Guard. Today he rents about 150 acres where he grows soybeans and corn. He also works for area farmers who contract with ag giant Monsanto to grow seed corn. In these fields, the entire ear of corn is harvested for a nearby seed facility to use to develop next year's seed. Come harvest time, farmers here band together to share their equipment. Veteran farmer Mark Hazer says that just makes sense.
You just can't afford to own everything yourselves anymore.
Why is that?
Well, it's the cost. The initial cost is so high that you have to be able to spread this stuff out over more and more acres to make it worthy of being able to have it.
When these established farmers need a loan, they visit Utica, Nebraska banker Larry Rogers. He says unless a person has left farmland by their family, they're pretty much out of luck.
It has gotten more difficult with the prices as they are today, even with the good prices for grain. I think it's more difficult for a young person to get started.
There were nearly 180,000 farmers under the age of 35 in 1997. A decade later, there are fewer than 120,000. Ernie Goss is an economist at Omaha's Creighton University. He says agriculture's appeal as an investment is one of the reasons.
You're sitting in New York and you say, well, I don't know. I've never even been to Nebraska, but I'm going to buy some Nebraska land. And you have these groups coming together. You have individuals that are buying farmland, driving up farmland prices to prices we've not seen before.
Goss says even though the Federal Reserve is keeping interest rates low for the next few years, banks simply aren't lending to high-risk first-time farmers. Matt Wildman fits that profile. He's a 22-year-old University of Nebraska student about to graduate with a degree in agriculture economics. He wants to land a job with an ag company or start his own fertilizer business.
The biggest challenge, at least in my position, coming out of college with no assets to my name pretty much, no money, and trying to go get a loan for, you know, $50,000 or $80,000 or more just to start a business. It's not going to happen unless you have a co-signer. And my parents are willing to co-sign on something right now, but it's got to be something that's going to cash flow itself.
Veteran farmer Mark Hazer says most of his money is tied up in his operation and not accessible, so he has this sage advice for any new farmer.
If you want to die rich, then become a farmer, because that's about all you're gonna do as far as on the rich factor is you're going to die that way.
But it's only on paper that these established farmers appear rich. With today's high commodity prices, they're not in the business of selling acreage, making it more difficult for young wannabe farmers to work the land. For NPR News, I'm Clay Masters.
The savannas of Africa are among the few places where big grazing animals still roam freely. But people are raising more cattle there, and some ranchers resort to shooting wild animals. The conventional thinking is that animals such as zebra and buffalo eat the grass that cattle need. But no one in Africa had really tested that notion scientifically until now. As NPR's Christopher Joyce reports, scientists who did got a surprise.
Wilfred Odadi studies African wildlife and cattle. Cattle ranchers in his native Kenya tell him they resent the wildlife.
One of the reasons they do that is that they see wildlife as potentially competing with their livestock.
Competing for grass in places that can be bone dry one month and lush the next. Odadi works with the African Wildlife Foundation and studies at Princeton University. He and a team of scientists decided to test this notion of dietary competition on the savanna. They fenced in some cattle to eat by themselves. They let other cattle graze outside with wildlife, mostly zebras. It turned out that during the dry season, the zebras did eat the cattle's lunch. The cattle didn't gain as much weight as their fenced-in brethren. But ecologist Truman Young says during the wet season, it was just the opposite.
The exciting result was that when the grass was growing vigorously, when it was wet, grazing by the zebras actually made the remaining grass more accessible or more palatable to the cattle. what happened was the cattle gained more weight in the presence of zebra.
Young is a plant specialist at the University of California at Davis. When he looks at a cow, he sees grass. That's what cows are made of. He says when some grass gets too long, it gets rank, tough, and fibrous.
What the zebras do is they lop that off. That encourages the regrowth of fresh shoots from the base, and those fresh shoots are just more edible. It's like having the choice of having, you know, bran muffins or blueberry muffins, I guess.
What the zebras are doing, in ecology speak, is facilitating the cattle, actually helping the cattle eat better. Johann Dutoit grew up in Africa and is an ecologist at Utah State University. He says the lack of competition among grazing animals, at least in the wet season, makes sense if you've seen big herds of them in the wild.
If you were to go to the Serengeti or indeed any other savanna, you would see multiple species of hoofed mammals, grazing mammals, standing shoulder to shoulder out there.
The research appears in the journal Science. Dutoit, who was not part of the research team, says it has real ramifications for wildlife, which is in decline in most parts of Africa. Landowners just don't see a profit in having wildlife around.
They will not invest in maintaining wildlife if they can convert their land to cropland or have more intensive cattle production, et cetera, et cetera. And so those are the areas where you're getting these really major conflicts between wildlife and cattle.
But he says cattle ranchers could let their livestock graze with zebras in the wet season, then pen them in during dry spells. The research did not find any advantage for cattle from sharing their meals with big plant eaters like elephants or giraffe, but Dutoit says it's worth looking into. Many of these big mammals evolved together by eating different kinds of plants. He's begun his own study to see if bison and cattle can facilitate each other's diets on the plains of Utah, where the deer and the antelope still roam. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm David Green, sitting in for Renee Montagne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Today in Your Health, we'll ask about the best way to relieve pain. Although first, we look at why children have a love affair with sugar and how it can help lessen their pain. Gretchen Kudakron reports.
Ask a child if they like sweets, and the conversation is bound to go something like this. What kind of sweet things do you like?
Toast with sugar on it, ice cream, cookies.
Would you, for example, ever put sugar on your Frosted Flakes or anything like that? Would you put more sugar on it?
Yes.
Most kids, like 8-year-old Keely McGinty, love sugar. And according to researcher Julie Minella of the Monell Chemical Senses Center, that sweet tooth is biologically hardwired from birth.
We know that the baby, the newborn, can detect sweet and will actually prefer sweeter solutions to less sweet ones. So the basic biology of the child, they don't have to learn to like sweet or salt. It's there from before birth.
Unlike adults, who often find overly sugary things unpleasant, Minella says kids simply taste things differently.
They actually are living in different sensory worlds when it comes to these basic tastes. They prefer much more intense sweetness and saltiness than the adult, and it doesn't decrease until late adolescence. And we have some evidence they may be more sensitive to bitter taste.
A preference for sweet, caloric substances during rapid growth may have given children an evolutionary advantage when calories were scarce. The fact is that sugar just doesn't taste good to children. It actually makes them feel good, too. Minella's research has shown that sugar is a natural pain reliever in babies, and many hospitals even put a sweet-tasting liquid in a baby's mouth during circumcisions or heel stick procedures to help lessen the pain.
So it's much more powerful than we can imagine when it comes to sweets and children.
In order to better understand the power of sugar, Minella and others actually measured this preference for sweet tastes in the laboratory. They gave adults and children of all ages water mixed with various amounts of sugar and asked them which ones they preferred. And while adults prefer sugar concentration similar to that of a can of soda, children prefer at least twice that concentration. And when it comes to younger children, the more, the better. Is there anything that's too sweet for you that you say, ooh, that's too much sugar?
No.
Never?
Mm-mm.
You really can't find a point at which the sugar solutions are too sweet. You can keep putting sugar in to the point where you can't dissolve it in the water anymore, and they still like it.
That's Sue Coldwell, a researcher at the University of Washington who's studied sweet preferences in children. She says that a child's tastes change around age 15 or 16 when children go through puberty. She was curious why that was, so she and her colleagues gave the same sugar water test to adolescents, while simultaneously measuring a marker of bone growth in their urine. What they found was that kids who were still growing preferred sweets, and those whose growth had already stopped had taste preferences similar to adults.
So we found support for that old notion that our grandmothers had, that when you're growing rapidly, your preference for these highly sweet caloric substances increases. And then as your growth slows down, the preference drops.
Exactly how this all works is still somewhat of a mystery, but Coldwell says that one important clue lies in the discovery that growing bones actually secrete hormones that can influence metabolism. Other well-known metabolic hormones like leptin and insulin have been shown to act on brain areas that control cravings and appetite, and even directly bind to the tongue where they affect the preference for sweet tastes. And Caldwell suspects that the hormones from growing bones may be doing the same thing.
I don't know for sure, but I'm very suspicious that the bones are somehow telling either the brain or the tongue that there's energy needed for their growth and signaling for that preference to increase.
In a modern world of calorie overload and childhood obesity, cravings for sugar are no longer the evolutionary advantage they once might have been. And if the goal is to get children to reduce their intake of sugar, understanding the biology behind their cravings is a first step. For NPR News, I'm Gretchen Kuda-Crowen in Cleveland.
And for more on sugar's effects, check out NPR's new food blog, which is ironically called The Salt. It's at npr.org.
And our last word in business today is top treats out on the street. Pupusas took the highest honor at New York's 7th annual Vendy Awards. That's a competition for the best street vendor food.
And the cart known as Solbert Pupusas is the winner of the coveted Vendy Cup. Chef Reina Bermudez makes thick Salvadoran tortillas from maize flour and fills them with savories like pork and cheese.
She told the New York Daily News that her pupusas are special because she makes everything with a lot of love. Now, there is a precious commodity that does not go up and down with the market, Steve. That's the Business News on Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Greene.
I'm Steve Inskeep.